Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
We've been chasing my next guest for the last 5 years, actually, right? And he's finally agreed to take our call. So look, he's probably the best known social scientist in the world right now. He's written several books, actually, that have kind of defined various cultural moments. You might have heard of The Coddling of the American Mind, The Happiness Hypothesis. This is another one. But his latest book, The Anxious Generation, How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness, has made him probably the leading voice in the world on the damage that phones and social media are doing to our children and our young people. Jonathan Hyde, you're very welcome to the show.
Oh, well, thank you, Brendan. And I wasn't playing hard to get. I was just trying to write these books.
And I'm glad you got your research done before you came on with us, because we're rigorous around here. So listen, before we get to the problem, will we start with the symptom? So you've dug deep into the figures here. Tell me about the trends in mental health of so-called Generation Z in the last 15 years. Mm-hmm.
Sure. Well, I'll tell you about the trends in the United States, but then the surprising discovery was that it's the exact same in all the English-speaking countries and other parts as well, but all the English-speaking countries are going through the exact same thing at the same time. And it is that there wasn't really much of a trend in anything from the 1990s, late 90s through 2010, even 2011, no sign of a crisis. And then all of a sudden, it's as though somebody somewhere in the world flipped a switch and girls around the world started being taken to hospital emergency rooms, mostly for self-harm. Rates of depression and anxiety shot up. Rates of suicide increased in the Anglo countries, although not necessarily around the world. So we know that this is not just that kids suddenly decided, hey, let's celebrate mental illness, because the hospital admission data backs up the self-report data. So we have a collapse of mental health. It starts very suddenly around 2012, plus or minus a year or two. And nobody has come up with another explanation that could work around the world. You know, people point to things that might work in the US, but why would girls in Iceland suddenly get depressed and anxious? And I should say, it's not just girls. Boys, too, are doing much worse, but the increase is much sharper, much more sudden for girls. For boys, it goes up more gradually.
And not just, you don't just date this to the introduction of smartphones, but other specific things as well. The like button and front-facing cameras on phones in 2010.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And so the key to understanding how we got here is to realize that the technology changed gradually, and most of it was marvelous. So when the internet came in the 1990s, those of us old enough to remember being adults who suddenly got omniscience, like, what, you mean I can ask anything and I get the answer within 1 second? So the internet was amazing in the 1990s. We all loved it, and there was no sign that it was hurting the millennial generation. And then the smartphone comes in, and it's amazing. And it, you know, it has music and camera. It has a flashlight. And social media comes in. And early social media was not particularly harmful. It was literally designed to help connect people. That's what it used to be. So all of this together by 2008, 2009 is really not a problem. It's kind of magical. But then a series of things happen. So as you mentioned, we suddenly get the like button and the retweet button, and social media changes to become much more viral, because now it's not about connecting with your friends. It's about the news feed and what can we feed to you to keep you on and keep you looking at advertisements. So once social media has sort of gotten its hooks into everybody, but especially teens, Facebook learns how to monetize those hooks. And so it gets much more viral. The front-facing camera comes in 2010. Instagram is invented in 2010. And so by 2012 is the year in the United States when most people have a smartphone with social media. You know, maybe a year or two later in other developed countries. And so in 2010, teens were mostly using flip phones to text each other, which is fine. But by 2015, teens were mostly sitting on their, you know, sitting down, looking at their smartphone for hours and hours a day, scrolling through the posts of other beautiful girls with perfect lives. And this is what I think pushed them over. It's not any one thing. It's the transition from what I've called a play-based childhood, where you're interacting with other kids, to a phone-based childhood, where most of your action is with your phone in the palm of your hand.
Okay, so tell me then a bit about the play-based childhood and the benefits of free play and risky play, and tell me what happened to that.
So I think it really helps to step back and look at it from an evolutionary point of view and to identify as mammals, we are mammals. And one thing that mammals have in common is that they have larger brains, especially the really social mammals like dogs and chimpanzees and humans. We have larger brains, and those brains, the genes don't tell the brain how to grow. The genes just start the ball rolling, and it's in interaction with the world that the brain, that different neurons will wire up and develop an adult, ultimately an adult configuration. So anyone who has ever raised a puppy or a kitten knows these little creatures have to play. They have to play. You can't just feed them and, you know, and wait for them to turn into adults. It's a biological imperative to play because that's what wires up the brain. And boy, do you see that. Anybody who has had toddlers, children, even up through age 12, 13, they are so playful. And that's a biological imperative. They need to play physically. They need rough and tumble play, especially the boys. They need imaginative play. And they need to play together. Something magical happens when kids are moving in synchrony, when they're reacting to each other instantly, like on a football field. And that's the way childhood used to be. Any older listener listening to me, I'm sure, was out playing by the time they were age 7 or 8. This was true across the English-speaking world until the 1990s, early 2000s. And then we gradually get afraid of our neighbors, at least in the U.S. I don't know if it happened in Ireland. But we start locking up our kids, say, oh, no, you can't go outside. You might get kidnapped. But hey, look, you got a computer and this amazing internet is there. Why don't you learn to program or play video games? So the play-based childhood begins to fade out in America in the 1990s. As far as I can tell, in Canada and the UK, I don't know about Ireland, but in Canada and the UK, it also faded out, even though those countries don't have the crazy crime rates that America had in the 70s and 80s. So we gradually take away play. We give them more and more screens. The screens aren't particularly toxic at first, but between 2010 and 2015, we have what I call the great rewiring of childhood. And now we have a toxic childhood, which is why kids born in 1996, which is the beginning of Gen Z, are really different from kids born in, say, 1993, because they went through puberty, all of puberty, with a smartphone and Instagram and a front-facing camera, whereas the millennial generation didn't get that stuff until they were maybe 17, 18, 19 years old.
Okay, so if it was there in your adolescence, you were particularly vulnerable to being rewired by it, essentially.
Exactly, especially early adolescence, age 10 to 13.
Okay, now you talk about four foundational harms, right? And look, we don't have time to get deep into all of them, and some of them people will know them all too well. Parents will: sleep deprivation, attention fragmentation, addiction. Tell me about social depreciation. So is the worry that these kids never learned how to have like real in-person embodied human relationships?
Exactly. So what we have very good data on this in the US, and I've seen some good data from the UK as well. There are studies called time use studies where you track, you know, a few thousand people and you get them to fill out logs. You know, what were you doing at this time? What were you doing at this time? And you can figure out how much time are they spending eating? How much time are they spending watching television? How much time are they spending on their phone or on social media or playing with friends? And what we see is that older people in their 30s, 40s, 50s, they spend, I think, 30 to 40 minutes a day with friends on average in the United States. And that doesn't change much. You see the graphs go down during COVID. So between 2019 and 2021, those numbers go down for adults. But for the youngest group in this data set, age 15 to 24, we see something really shocking, which is that they used to spend 2 hours a day with their friends. That's what kids did. You hang out with your friends. But that begins dropping a little bit in the early 2000s as they're spending more time online and video games. But once they get their smartphones around 2012, that line plummets to the point where teens are not spending much more time with friends than adults are. And that's insane. Adults are married, they have jobs. Teens are supposed to be playing. And so the most connected generation is the loneliest. The more you are connected through devices, the less time you have to spend with human beings, including the human beings sitting next to you. You see kids sitting around, each looking at their own phone.
So it's qualitatively different because, you know, people will say, well, they are hanging out with their friends and connecting with their friends online. And a lot of the time they're connecting with, you know, certain types of kids are able to connect with people who are like them, who might not be there physically in their own community. But do you think that that is not as beneficial as being there IRL, so to speak?
Exactly. That was a reasonable hypothesis 15 years ago when this was coming in and people said, oh, well, now it's easier. They can meet more friends. And we heard a lot about, you know, LGBTQ kids who are isolated. But that argument really needs to be examined because, you know, isolated kids who can't find anyone like them, the internet solved that in the 1990s. That was one of the marvelous things. They could find all kinds of ways to connect. They could get information. They don't need an algorithm-driven, newsfeed-based platform designed by a company known to be brutal in grabbing their attention at all costs. In fact, LGBTQ kids are hurt the most by time on social media, and they are the most likely to wish that it never existed. So yes, it turns out that we are a biological species. We evolved for certain kinds of play and interaction and flirting and eye contact and touch. And you don't get any of that when you are sending DMs or texts.
So now, girls and boys, right? So as you kind of alluded to earlier, the research suggests, you say, and you've looked deep into all the research, that social media harms girls more than boys. I presume body image issues are central here, are they, for girls?
Mm-hmm. Yes, but there are so many different harms. And so let's just go through it. I'll go through it quickly. So girls and boys all rushed onto the phones when they got them, but they did slightly different things. The girls went for the visual platforms, especially Instagram, Pinterest, a few others, like photo-based video and photo-based. The boys went for video games and YouTube. They were more interested in watching videos. And also porn. The boys go for a lot of porn. And so what the girls are doing is, you know, now girls' social life in adolescence has always been very tricky. If anyone's seen the movie Mean Girls, it captures some universal truths. There's bullying, especially around age, 11, 12, it can be really bad.
And girls bully differently to boys. They tend to
exactly.
Do that.
Exactly. So boys bully in a way that you think of as bully, like threatening and I'll beat the hell out of you if you don't do this. But girls don't punch and kick and hit very much. Girls destroy other girls' reputations or relationships. And a smartphone with hundreds of platforms where you can be anonymous, you can spread rumors, you can put up ugly photographs. A smartphone just makes it so easy for any girl to destroy any other girl. And so girls are much more likely to be cyberbullied. And when we see this huge rise in suicide, very, very often it's preceded by being cyberbullied. That is, it's not just like a few kids are picking on you. It's now the entire school is laughing at you because someone engineered a humiliation for you. And that's a very strong spur to suicide. You just want to disappear. So for a variety of reasons. Oh, and the social comparison that you mentioned, the body image, because girls are very sensitive about how they look and how they're changing. They're changing rapidly in early puberty. And what they see is photos of all these girls who are more beautiful than them, even if they're not really more beautiful, but in their perfectly curated and edited photos, they are. So for all those reasons, social media hits girls harder.
You make an interesting point about boys, that boys were, you say, withdrawing from the world already before smartphones came along.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So what we see, you know, in it used to be a man's world. I mean, there's no doubt about that. And boys had more freedom than girls. But this begins to change in the 70s and 80s. What begins to happen is educational opportunities open up. Girls quickly begin to excel boys, to beat boys in school and education.
Which we agree is it's a good thing.
Absolutely. It's absolutely a good thing for opportunities to open up for everyone to reach their potential. And girls, the rise of girls across the English-speaking world is astonishing. They are reaching their potential. At the same time, boys are spending a lot more time. Boys are easier to lure into technology. Boys take to technology quicker than girls do. And so boys really went for video games. They really went for computers and programming. They started, you know, computer companies. So all that, that part is good. But they began to find that school is boring. And in America, at least, we freaked out in the 1980s about the fact that we were not top of the world. We were declining. And we said, how about no more recess, no more shop class? Let's give them just more math and more science. We've got to get those. And this is really bad for boys. Boys need to run around more, especially at the younger ages. So school becomes more and more hostile to boys, more and more conducive to girls. Technology becomes more and more conducive to boys. They love it. And so boys start spending less effort on school and real life pursuits, working outside the home, and much more time online. And so, you know, when I wrote the book, I presented a picture of girls who are being destroyed by social media, and boys a little less so. But what I'm coming to realize, especially after the book came out, is that if we look at boys and girls at age 14, it's clear the girls are doing worse. The boys are actually having fun. The video games are amazing. The boys are enjoying the video games. They're enjoying the porn. So it seems like the girls are doing worse. But the girls are finishing school and they're learning things and they're getting jobs. Whereas the boys graduate from you know, high school, secondary school, or even university. And they're spending an awful lot of time. A lot of them are addicted to video games and porn. So they're essentially taking themselves out of circulation, and they're much more likely to be living at home with their parents at the age of 30 than the girls are.
Okay. There's a few people texting in there, one, or just tuned into the conversation, wondering who I'm speaking to. I'm speaking to Jonathan Haidt, who is the author of The Anxious Generation, How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness. And people also pointing out that they are familiar with a lot of the ideas he's talking about here, but they weren't sure where they had come from originally. So a lot of it is from Jonathan Haidt and his writing over the last few years. Jonathan, let's get down to the nitty gritty then, okay? And you talk about, you mention one parent in the book, and they use that phrase, which will, a lot of parents will identify with to some extent or another. They lost their child to the phone. And then equally, yes, people will say it's very hard to deny your child a phone if everyone else has them. So what's your advice to parents?
Mm-hmm. So the reason that we lost our children is because the tech companies put us into what's called a social dilemma or a collective action trap. That is, if one kid gets a phone, it's not so terrible. If one kid in a community gets a phone, it's not so terrible. But if 10 kids get it and start talking about the other kids, well, then everyone feels, oh, I have to get one too. And once most kids have it, then everyone feels they have to have it or they are socially dead. They're left out. So that's how it came to be that almost all of our 10, 11, 12-year-olds have a smartphone and often social media. And what that means is that the way out is through collective action. Any parent who says, no, you can't have one, you're going to be the only one. And I've said that to my daughter. My 15-year-old daughter is the only one who doesn't have Snapchat in her school. And she actually accepts that now because she sees what Snapchat is doing to kids. But the way out is collective action. And so what I propose in the book is four simple norms. One, no smartphone before age 14. Two, no social media before 16. Three, phone-free schools, not in the pocket, not turned off and put in your backpack, but in a locker or an envelope at the front of the class, of the homeroom. Give kids 6 or 7 hours a day away from their phones, and amazing things happen. They talk to each other, they listen to their teachers, and every school that goes phone-free reports the same thing, which is, we hear laughter in the hallways again.
Kids, yeah, and actually that you do hear increasingly. There are parents in schools doing collective action in Ireland, and you do hear that it has changed the schools completely. Interesting you mention about the putting them away in the pouches, right? So yes, we had a big fuss here just recently. The annual budget at the end of last year, the government committed to spending 9 million euro, I think it was, on phone pouches for schools so that the phones were locked away for the day. And some people thought that this was a huge waste of money, and that could they not just, you know, put them away, put them in their bags or whatever. Is it a waste of money?
So it is the most expensive option. It's not terribly expensive, but it is a cost, especially when you roll it out over a whole country. These are the Yonder pouches that have a magnetic lock. And from what I hear, those do work well. Schools that do it do get great benefits. But I do want to point out that there's a very cheap option, which especially in smaller schools works quite well. When kids come in the morning, at least in the United States, they have a homeroom. There's like one classroom, like this is my homeroom. This is where I hang my jacket. This is where I have a cubby or a hook or something. You just get a box and you get a bunch of padded paper, you know, padded mailing envelopes, and the kids decorate their own envelope. And when they come into homeroom, they drop their phone into their special envelope and the teacher keeps it at the front of the room. And at the end of the day, they get it back. So
okay, but the phone
schools,
needs to be away.
Schools are doing it.
It needs to be away from them, does it? Like if the phone is even physically there, is it a distraction?
That's right. Imagine a school. Imagine a rehab clinic full of heroin junkies. And the rule is, the rule is, you can keep your stash in your pocket. You can keep it in your backpack, but just don't shoot up during class time. That's what a lot of schools are basically
doing.
Okay,
so if you're in that position, I'm thinking about heroin all day. Then basically, yes.
Exactly. The kids are addicted. So this is very important. Any school that bans phone use during class time, but lets them use the phone in between classes or at lunch, is not getting much benefit at all, because the addicts are getting their shot. There's drama going on all day. The only thing that works and works brilliantly is away for the day, 6 or 7 hours a day away from their phones.
Okay. Can we circle back? I'm intrigued from the point of view of healer, heal thyself. So you didn't allow your daughter to have Snapchat. At what point did she start wanting to have it? And how bad was the hatred for you and stuff?
Well, both of my kids, when they transitioned from what we call elementary school around age 10 to middle school, or you know, around age 11, they both told me, in New York City public schools, they both told me, everyone has Snapchat, everyone has Instagram. Can I have Instagram? And I said, no way, no way. And 2 years later, my daughter actually agreed. And she said, you know, I'm glad I don't have it, because she said, because the Instagram girls are stupid. She sees how it makes them stupid and shallow. So she never actually complained about not having Instagram. Snapchat's a little different because it seems like it's just a texting program and the kids use it to communicate.
Yeah.
And I asked my, I've been studying Snapchat, and, you know, if that was all it would be fine. But the thing is, Snapchat has disappearing messages. It is designed to send naked photos and do drug deals. And that's a lot of what happens. So we're writing up a document now analyzing all the harms from Snapchat. Snapchat gets 10,000 reports of sextortion, not a year, a month, every month. And that's just what's reported to them.
Okay.
These are kids whose lives are ruined. Some will commit suicide.
Okay. My heart is sinking there, and I'm sure a lot of people is, because we don't allow Instagram in the house, but Snapchat, it seemed to be how all the kids communicate these days.
That's
and if
right.
you weren't
so,
on it, you,
right.
weren't so you, need in, to, you weren't in the loop, you know?
That's right. So you need to talk to your kids, because, you know, the big problem with Snapchat is that it's connecting you with strangers, many of whom want sex or money from your child. And so talk to your child. Have they ever seen a drug menu? Have they ever been, has anyone ever asked them for a photograph? Because what they do is these sextortion rings, they pretend to be a sexy young girl. The boys are particularly vulnerable. They flirt with them. They exchange photos. And once they get a photo of a boy showing his face and his penis, now they can say, send me $500 right away.
Okay, yeah. And we had a very shocking case of that recently in this country. And look, obviously Snapchat would say it was not designed for nudes or drugs. It was designed to be an entirely benevolent communication. So what social media do your kids have, if any?
So my son did create his own Instagram account when he was 15 because he had joined the track team. And he did it without telling me, but he has been so responsible. And he said he's not posting at all. He's just using it to be able to communicate with the boys on his track team. And I said, okay, you know what? That's actually good. Go ahead. My daughter, it would be much more vulnerable to harm from Instagram. So I've really held the line there. At 15, she still does not have Instagram or Snapchat.
Okay.
They are on a running app, because my kids are both runners. There is a running app, which is technically social media, because the kids see each other's runs and run times. But that, I think, is actually pretty good. They're not talking with strangers who are asking them for photos.
And what kind of other rules do you have around phones in your house in terms of time allowed and all that? Do you have pretty hard and fast boundaries?
Well, I'll tell you, so I wish I'd been much stricter. We had a policy.
The whole world agrees,
But so let me just share the one that I really miss. So we do have a policy. When you come in, you put your phone on the kitchen counter, you can charge it, and that's where it's supposed to stay. And then, of course, sometimes they take it, they use it for something or other. So I wish you'd been stricter there. But the big thing that I wish I had done, and anyone with young kids, please listen. Make a very clear policy from the time your kids are little. No screens in the bedroom ever. You never have a screen in the bedroom. And when I was a kid, that was the rule. Like, nobody would have a television in the bedroom. That's crazy. The kid's going to watch TV all day. So have that rule when the kids are young. Now, at some point, you know, maybe with the 10, 11, 12, they're getting a lot of homework. At some point, you're going to have to say, okay, you can take a laptop into your bedroom for homework. But you have to establish the principle that that the bedroom is not a place to be hooked up to companies and strangers. You don't want strangers talking to your kid at night on screens.
Jonathan, is there any danger that we are old fuddy-duddies and this is an old-fashioned moral panic like we had around rock and roll and television, mm-hmm. and that it's just another development in the world, another generation living and interacting differently?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the main counter argument that I get. And, you know, 10 years ago, that would have been a reasonable argument. But this is very different from every previous moral panic for several reasons. The first is that the kids themselves share it. Previous moral panics, the adults freaked out about comic books, but the kids said, no, we love the comic books. We did a survey of Gen Z, and we found that half of them wish that TikTok had never been invented. Yeah. They're on these platforms because they're trapped. They feel trapped. They don't like it. So that's very different. Another difference is that with previous moral panics, there wasn't an instant increase, a doubling of depression, anxiety, self-harm, suicide. So this one really shows up in the data. And the third is that a traditional moral panic is over nothing, but the media makes up stories or they exaggerate stories and people freak out because they read a report about a kid who read a comic book and he killed his mother. Maybe that happened once, maybe it happened zero times. This time around, it's stories about a girl who was lively and fun and happy and went on, got a phone and Instagram, and within 3 months, she was morose and had an eating disorder. And this is not a story that you read in the newspaper. This is the story that your sister told you about her daughter. This is the story you see about your own children. This is everywhere. This is in so many families. So this is not, this cannot be dismissed as a moral panic. This is a mental health emergency that we all see.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. Okay, listen, you gave us the thing about no screens in the bedroom. Just before we finish up today, because so many parents texting in just saying fighting a losing battle and everything. Mm-hmm. Have you any other first step for people listening today? I think parents particularly.
Yes. Remember that this is a collective action problem. It's very hard to do it by yourself. So talk to the parents of your kids' best friends and agree to do things together. Because if you say, okay, you know, look, I made a mistake by letting you have everything in your bedroom. We have a new policy. You know, everything has to be out by 10 o'clock. And guess what? You know, Billy's parents are doing the same thing and Bobby's parents are doing the same thing. We're all doing this. Then the kids don't feel cut off and they'll probably will understand. See, this is the great thing about Gen Z is that they're not in denial. They see the problems.
Okay, so we need to help them, but we can't do it alone. Okay, The Anxious Generation is out now. It's published by Penguin. Jonathan Hyde, I'm so glad we finally got to talk and thank you so much. And I hope we get to talk again because you've a lot of other books and a lot of other different ideas. I know you have a kind of a part two of this about more general matters coming. So hopefully talk to you again. Thanks, Jonathan.
Thank you. I hope listeners will go to anxiousgeneration.com for more information.
Okay.